You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, he goes, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once them bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Two minutes after 8 o'clock on the west coast of the United States. Joining me, I think from the east coast, but I'm not sure, is Adam Linehan. And pronounces it like a good Irishman. So, Adam, good morning. Welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me. And, I am on the east coast. I'm in New York, in Brooklyn.
How are things in Brooklyn today? Is that where you live? Are you just there for business, or what's going on?
Yeah, I've lived here pretty much since I got out of the Army, and this is also where Casting Purpose is. Well, they're in the city, but in Manhattan, but I live in Brooklyn, and I usually work from home.
Attaboy. All right, you don't sound like you're from Manhattan. No. So let's learn about you, Adam. As I mentioned before, Adam's a writer for Task and Purpose. He's a veteran of the United States Army. So let's learn about you. Born and raised where?
I was born and raised in Austin, Texas, and I joined the Army out of there in 2006, and I enlisted as a medic. And I was in the Army from 2006 to 2012, and then a few months later, I sold all of my belongings and moved to New York to start being a journalist.
All right. How does the Army get on your radar when you're a young guy?
I wasn't really, I didn't really kind of know what I was doing with my life. And one night, my buddy just said, "Hey, let's go to the recruiting station and join the Army." I had dropped out of college, and so it just seemed like the practical thing to do. And it's something that I was always, kind of interested in doing. And so we went to the recruiting station the next day, and, I ended up joining, and he didn't.
How many guys say stuff? How many guys say stuff like that? Yeah, this guy, I remember a friend of mine telling me, this guy in my hometown joined, I saw him, and it's like, "Hey, man, what are you doing?" He's like, "I joined the Marine Corps." And he said, he's a fat guy. He's like, "He joined the Marine Corps. I want to join the Marine Corps then." So this guy ships to boot camp, and this other guy goes down, and he says, I want to go with him. And they say, "Yeah, you can't go. It's too late. And we'll send you in 2 weeks, though." Signs all the paperwork, does it. So the day before he's leaving, he sees the fat guy back. What happened? "Oh, they threw me out." they threw me out. So he joins, and just funny stuff. Tell me about becoming a medic. Is that something that you sought? Is that why?
I think it was just kind of like on the list of things that were available at that time, or at least available to me. It just seemed like something that, a job that I could, get interested in, and I was excited about. And I like the idea of like learning medicine and, being someone who, had the responsibility of taking care of people. And it ended up like, I think, working out for me, it fit my personality. I don't think I could have been an infantryman I served with the infantry, but,
yeah.
I don't know if I really kind of had that mentality.
I want to warn you, okay, in addition to being of Irish descent, I'm an infantryman, so be very careful what you're about to say, Adam. All right, be very careful.
No.
Let me tell you.
I have nothing but respect for infantrymen.
That was the appropriate thing to say, by the way. How are corpsmen? how are medics ever right in the head? I mean, and I say this to people, you don't understand. It's not like being an EMT, right? The people you treat, they're your friends, okay? And it doesn't happen like John Wayne in the Sands of Iwo Jima where you get shot and you tip over and it's all silent. That's not the way that shit works. People are screaming and yelling and praying and begging you to save them. People around you are screaming at you, just telling you to save them. And it's how are you guys ever right in the head? Or are you?
That's a different, completely different.
It's a completely different interview, but you can answer it now. It's rough.
No, it's a good question. I remember towards the end of my second deployment to Afghanistan when I was with the infantry, kind of thinking like, how am I ever going to recover from this? Like psychologically,
right.
Because you know I was in numerous situations, you know, where I saw guys get fucked up, or like situations where I thought I was gonna get hurt while treating someone else, and it really left a mark on me. For a while I couldn't eat like red meat and stuff like that, and I couldn't get the smell out of my nose. But eventually I got over it, and, I think like picking up, just moving straight into another profession like, journalism really helped. You know, I never really kind of stopped to ruminate on it.
Okay. So at some point in the future, when you do stop and it starts steeping out of the woods, you'll be headed down to a vet center near you, yes?
Yeah, that's the plan. I've been meaning to go. I mean, I tried the VA once back in Texas, and I gave up.
Right.
You know?
No, which is probably what, you know, most do, you know, after two or three times, it's like, this is too hard. I'm all right. I'm not that fucked up to have to, because this experience right here, this is just pissing me off even more. So maybe it's better that I just stay away from this and handle my business. Interesting. So yeah, the whole, you know, I talked to guys who, I was with a medic a week ago, maybe 10 days ago at a funeral, his Navy corpsman, at Khe Sanh in Vietnam. And it's like, how are you right in the head? And he looked at me and he said, I'm not, honestly. He said, how do you recover from that? And, so I think it's an interesting proposition. One we don't talk about a whole lot, you know, oh, you're a medic. Oh, you're like an EMT. No, I'm not. Yeah. I did treat some people I didn't know, but the majority of my work are on friends of mine, and I think it's fundamentally different. It fundamentally scars you and sears you very, very deeply, and so interesting group you're a part of there, Adam. Much as you know, much love and respect for you guys. You're a special class of citizen in the American military. The angels of the battlefield, really. And so you're allowed your own weirdness and whatnot because of the work you do. And anybody who's ever known, everybody's never known medics and the way they get treated and corpsmen, the way they get treated, knows that, they get wide latitude in terms of being themselves because they're the docs. And so, tell me about, you join in 2006. Where do you go? What do you do?
My first duty station was probably the worst duty station in the Army. I was at Fort Polk in Louisiana. If you've ever heard of that place,
I have.
It's like in the middle of nowhere, Western Louisiana,
and in a foreign country, Louisiana. They don't even speak English down there, right? It's like, hello.
Yeah.
Hello, Louisiana.
And so from there, I was with a support hospital, like a CAS, you know, and we deployed to Iraq for 15 months during the surge. And I worked in a prison in Baghdad, And it was a pretty low key deployment. And then from there, I reenlisted to go up to Campbell, and then I was assigned to the 101st with the 2nd 502nd Infantry Battalion. And, 9 months later, I guess, yeah, Obama announced the troop surge into Afghanistan, and so we got orders to roll out. And I got assigned to, like, my infantry platoon, like, a week before we deployed, and all of my, you know, kind of fundamental soldiering skills were super rusty by that point, and I didn't know the basics of, like, infantry tactics, and so I pretty much had to learn on the job. And, you know, being, like, a new guy in an infantry platoon is pretty rough, and being a new medic in an infantry platoon is a strange experience. And and there was like a lot of there's kind of this adjustment period where they were trying to figure out if they could trust me with their lives. And and then we went to Kandahar in 2010, like the beginning of the summer of 2010, and we were there for a year.
I was in Kandahar in 2000. I was in Kandahar in 2010.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Where were you at?
Well, I went through there on my way home for leave. But we were out in Helmand province in Marja,
oh, yeah.
in the Marja area. So we were west of you guys. But
yeah.
We used to keep our eye on
we
you.
We went out west. So I was like, I think pretty kind of closer in your direction than Kandahar City. I was in Zari district. And then we went and did some air assault missions out even closer to you guys in Maywan,
you can't see, you can't actually, like, see the edge of the world from Maywan, but it's pretty close. Okay, it's pretty close. There's nothing, literally, there isn't anything out there, and so into these voids, the Taliban would go, and you'd see the air guys get after them. What so that's your second deployment. Are you done then? Do you come home and get out?
Yeah, I got, you know, I came home, I got promoted to E5, and I, you know, just kinda, yeah, I just spent like the next like year and a half of my enlistment just training other medics who were going out to Afghanistan, which was actually a pretty rewarding experience. And you know, because I felt like I learned so much during that deployment, on both deployments actually, and I was glad that I was able to kind of hand off some of those, like, you know, those lessons that I learned the hard way to these guys before they went out and did it for real. And then I got out, I went back to college, finished my degree, and came up to New York.
When you went back, where'd you go?
It's a small college in Austin called St. Edwards. It's like a tiny little, it's like a local college, you know, a few thousand people.
And what'd you major in?
Just down. I majored in English literature.
Nice. You know what? I tell people, if you don't know what you want to do, major in English, because you'll come out well-read, well-spoken, and well-written, and you can take that and do anything with it. But nobody listens to me. It's like, no, that's too hard. I'll do poli-sci. That's fucking useless. I know, but it's easy. Hey, if you're going to do poli-sci, just do history. It's like all you do is memorize stories and then tell them back. It's like easy. It's like a major for dumb people. Now, I know people can go on, and history is really interesting, and I personally love it, but come on. What are you going to do with a history degree? Tell stories? You're going to go to a pub and tell stories the rest of your life? Come on. So, I want to go back. Tell me about life-saving in Afghanistan. I would imagine that you faced what most everybody else faced was IEDs and direct fire injuries. Tell me about life saving. How do you do it?
Well, you improvise. You know, if you're like a, you know, a specialist in infantry platoon. I mean, I remember like the first time I ever was in you know, treated like a mass casualty situation. the lead truck in this convoy, right outside our outpost got blown up by an IED. It was an MRAP, and the explosion was so big that it like threw the MRAP up in the air and put it on its back end. So the front grill was like pointing to the sky, if that makes sense.
Wow.
And they were able to like drop the ramp. And by the time I got up there, another medic had already started kind of dragging the guys out. And as soon as I had treated plenty of injuries in Iraq at the hospital and in the prison, but this was different, you know, like my adrenaline was pumping and all that. And I remember literally seeing, training mannequins, like all of the dudes who were wounded. When I first looked at them, I saw training mannequins. Like my training just kicked in immediately, and it took me like 30 seconds, to realize that it wasn't a training scenario. It was really bizarre.
Right.
And at that point, you know, we're just kind of scrambling around trying to identify, you know, the worst wounds and, you know, triage everybody. I remember the driver was up in the driver's seat, and the it's pretty long, and, you know, the nose of the truck is up, and his legs were broken, just completely broken. It had blown out the bottoms of his feet, and he had to fall down from the driver's seat because he couldn't climb down.
Did he shove himself out the door?
No, he couldn't get out the door. He had to come because, you know, it's like one big kind of like open space. It's like he just fell from the driver's seat down to us, and we tried to catch him. We did catch him, but his legs were broken. And, you know, I remember me and the other medic, we couldn't figure out. He was screaming and crying and all of this. We couldn't figure out what was going on. And eventually we looked down at his boots, and there was just blood pouring out of the porthole in his boots. And so we cut him off, and the entire bottoms of his feet had been blown out. And that's what I really learned about morphine, because I gave him like two shots of morphine, not realizing that when the muscle relaxes, that's when it starts to enter the bloodstream. And so, you know, I later heard from the flight medic that he almost flatlined. He almost stopped breathing because of the morphine I gave. But, you know, fortunately, everyone in that situation survived. And that was kind of my introduction to combat medicine. And, you know, a few days after that, yeah, I treated a couple little, like, three-year-old kids who got blown up by an IED also outside of our base. And but for the most part, it was blast injuries, some indirect fire. You know, we had suicide bomber. We got hit by a suicide bomber. We got hit by a car bomb. And a few gunshot wounds, which were relatively easy to treat compared to the blast injuries. Because, you know, you have, you know, like, you know, with like a suicide bomber, you know, they put all those little pellets, you know, they just pad their entire bodies with these little pellets. Like, you know, puts like 50 wounds in a guy. You have to go through and try and identify which ones hit an artery and stuff. It's always very stressful. And but that was my job. And I think, you know, part of the job of being a medic is to take control in situations like that, you know, because like your platoon sergeant, the infantry guys, the squad leaders, you know, they're good at taking control during firefights, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to keep their heads together when people get messed up. And I think that, you know, a big part of being a medic is having the ability to just like calm everyone down and, you know, take control of the situation.
No, because those things can get crazy because people are pissed, right? And then, like I said, this isn't just somebody whose leg's blown off, right? It's your friend, right? If we're all in a room and somebody farts, nobody has to tell us who farts, okay? That's how well we know each other, and that's how closely we've lived. Right? Yeah. Right? Am I right or wrong? You know.
You're absolutely right.
And so, but you're right. I mean, and so people are pissed, and like I said, it's not. I remember seeing it for the first time ever in the movie Apocalypse Now, where they're medevacking a soldier. He's a black soldier, and he's been shot in the thigh or somehow wounded in the thigh, and he's screaming. And it was the first time I ever saw anything like that, and it was in a movie. And I remember being very disturbed by that and thinking, what is that? What was that? And then, you know, the more I thought about it, and I thought, is that how people act? You know, and then the first time you're exposed to it, and the first person I ever saw shot, you know, he's yelling at me to open his black jacket, and he pulls out a scapula, and he starts saying the Hail Mary. And you're like, I thought, right? I mean, all that kind of shit that you did as part of your job, I mean, it just gets crazy, right? And you're trying to find body parts to send with the medevac. Maybe you can save, blah, 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 blah. And so it's heady stuff. If you give people listening who've never been a medic that have to do first aid, maybe it might be a car accident or something else. Give them a piece of advice from a professional medic.
Oh man, it's been so long. I used to have so much advice. I mean, you know, I think it's the important thing that I always would tell, you know, newer medics is to just keep moving. Don't, like, when you get to a casualty, don't give yourself any time to kind of stop and absorb the situation. You know, just start moving. If you start taking off their clothes, exposing the wound. If you don't know what your treatment is gonna be, there's other things that you can be doing in the meantime to kind of accelerate the process. But the second that you stop and kind of realize what's going on, it's gonna become a lot more nerve wracking, you know?
Yeah. Just do it.
Just get moving. And, you know, the other thing, and something that, you know, myself and the other medics in my company were really, really, really serious about was just keeping all of our gear as organized as possible. And not, you know, if you have even like a civilian aid bag or whatever, you know, if you have to memorize the location of everything because your brain's going to turn off when all of that's happening. And so it's just got to come down to muscle memory. And so streamlining our aid bags was something that we worked on, you know, constantly throughout the deployment, how to make everything more accessible and more kind of idiot proof.
Have you seen, I mean, some of the first aid kits you can buy now are pretty crazy. I mean, they're based off, you know, the IFAC and some other stuff. And some of the things in those first aid kits, from tourniquets to quick clot are straight off the battlefield. And if you go online, there's a number of places you can get them, and you throw them in your car. But as you said, checking it out every once in a while, knowing where stuff is, so if something does happen, you can. The other thing to me, the biggest thing is maybe taking charge, but don't be afraid to tell people what to do, because that is the thing. I saw a guy get hit on the 405 out here in California on a motorcycle that launched him. I pull my truck over, and all these people are standing on the freeway, right? Traffic's now stopped. He's laying there screaming and bleeding, but nobody would touch him, right? So I walked up and I said to him, I said, "Hey man, what's your name?" He goes, "My name's Alex." And I said, "Hey Alex, I'm Mac. How are you?" He goes, "What?" And I said, "How are you?" And he said, "Oh man, are you kidding me?" And I said, "Can you move your feet?" And he says, "Hold on." And he moves his feet. I said, "Can you move your fingers?" And he moves his fingers. And I said, "Hey Alex, I've seen some fucked up guys in my life, but you ain't one of them, okay? You're gonna be fine." And now he looks at me, and he goes, really? And I said, yeah, okay, so you're bleeding. I'm going to take care of the bleeding. You just relax, okay? And I said, and quit whining and being a pussy. And with that, he starts laughing. He goes, don't make me laugh. I'm like, I'm not, man. I'm just telling you. And these people are looking at me like, but you know what? It's that, I don't, it's not, it's just that demeanor that, you know, you're taking care of this, that it's going to be okay, even if it's not. Even if it's not, but there's this, there's this calming effect that you have on him, and then so I'm you know, I take care of him, I stop the bleeding, and now we're waiting for the, so the fire department finally shows up, and I'm sitting there talking to him, and so he's laying there, and I look at him, I said, is that your piece of shit motorcycle over there? And he says, yeah, what's it look like? I said, yeah, you ain't riding that thing for a while. He's like, God damn it. I said, what happened? And he said, I was riding and something flew up in front of me and hit me in the face and I launched and launched me. And so now the fire department guys show up and, you know, I stand up and they say, you know, what happened? I said, here, I just drove up and here's what I did. And they were, and I want to say of the four of them, three of them were veterans. And, so they start talking and then, you know, I said, okay, I'm out of here. And after I did my data dump, and so I squatted down and I said, hey, Alex. And he said, yeah. I said, be cool, man. And remember, don't be a pussy. With that, he starts laughing. The firefighters start laughing. But, you know, it's just, you know, again, sometimes it's not going to be okay. But your demeanor through all that is, you know, I think one of the great things that medics and corpsmen learn, this could have a calming sense and other people feed off that. And it really helps when things, when things go wrong and then you do your best to make them comfortable and all that. But, no, I've, again, like everybody who served, man, I have much admiration, respect. And honestly, Adam, I don't know how you're right in the head because that shit is tough. Because it's not strangers, it's friends, and so yeah. Someday get to a therapist, man.
Yeah, one day.
All right. Talk to me. So you get your degree in English, in English literature, and now and then after you do that, you decide I'm going to be a writer and I'm going to New York City. Talk to us how you get to becoming a writer, like a news reporter. Well, let me ask you this. How do you categorize yourself? Are you a reporter? Are you a feature writer?
Yes.
Are you a columnist? What the hell are you?
No, that's a good question. I'm a writer and a journalist. Sometimes I write. Sometimes, you know, I wear both hats and, okay. But I there is a very clear line between the two, one allows opinions and a lot more perspective and, you know, the other one is very fact driven. And, it's weird kind of being both. Cause I do a lot of essays, which is risky, right? Because,
right.
I want people to read my journalism, being as objective as possible. But then I write essays that are very opinionated. And as much in how can I let them know that I'm approaching each with a completely different mindset. They just kind of have to arrive at that conclusion themselves. I got into it because, we had journalists who were embedding with us, in Kandahar and I thought they were really cool. I thought they were brave for doing what they were doing because, you know, we weren't very welcoming.
Right.
And we made them feel like shit. It made them feel alienated and they, you know, they stuck with it and they had done it a million times before and they would just go off, without any protection sometimes. They would just hitchhike down the road, you know, to chase the story. And, I really admired that in my, and I, you know, I talked to them and the advice, you know, they kept giving me was go to New York, and just start doing it. And so that's what I did. And, I took a big gamble. I got an internship at Maxim, not really knowing what an internship was. And when I showed up, you know, after selling my truck, you know, my, for, you know, like $30,000 truck. It was pretty new at that time. You know, all of my furniture, everything, and coming up and showing up for the first day, and they were just like, okay, there's the coffee machine. Like, you know, like the coffee maker, and there's the coffee machine. You know, and here's some interviews to transcribe. And that was it. Like that's what they were expecting me to do. And I, you know, realized that they hadn't hired an intern in years. And, you know, I was really, you know, in this situation where it's like, shit, if I don't go above and beyond, this is all, I would have just wasted, you know, this would have been a big mistake. Right. And so I just, you know, worked. And one day one of the writers was out of the office and they needed someone to literally write a 50-word blurb for the front of the book or from the front of the magazine, you know, where the jokes and stuff used to be.
All right.
And this is
Maxim magazine, right?
Yeah, Maxim.
Okay. Got it.
And you know, so I volunteered to do it, and I put a lot of time into that 50 words, but I remember it going up the kind of editorial chain of command, and then it got to the editor-in-chief, and he goes, who wrote this? You know, I was like, that was me. And he was like, this is great. This is really funny. And then from that point on, you know, they were like, okay, we can trust him with 50 words. And then it became 75 words, 100 words. And I did that. You know, I moved to a freelance position. I did that for like a year straight, just writing things that were no bigger than a few hundred words, jokes and stuff like that. And eventually they hired me on full time as an editor and started letting me do actual reporting and stories and feature writing. And it was an incredible learning. I mean, I got super, a lot of it was luck, you know, and I was, and so I kind of got that conventional training in terms of magazine writing, how to structure stories. I worked with a lot of really, I mean, you wouldn't think it, but there was a lot of like really experienced and talented journalists who worked at Maxim during that time.
Right.
And they kind of took me under the wing. They appreciated the fact that I had been in the military because a big part of the audience, the Maxim audience, was military. And they didn't understand that world.
You couldn't go anywhere in Iraq or Afghanistan when, you know, in its heyday without seeing Maxim magazine.
Yeah. And they knew that.
Yeah.
And that's why they, and so being, you know, it was strange, but I don't think that I would have ever been able to be a journalist had I not been a veteran.
Yeah. No, they've opened up.
It was my foot in the door.
They've opened up. Yeah, they've opened up great doors. How do you get? So you started Maxim. Tell us about your career from there. Where do you go?
Oh man. So are you familiar with the film Range 15?
No.
So it's like this veteran-made zombie film that the guys who Nick Tomasano at Ranger Up and like the Article 15 guys like Matt Best, and Jared Taylor, they and like the Black Rifle Coffee Company guys,
they all
got together and made this film. And this was I was doing some military content at Maxim, but you know mostly I was just focused on things that you know writers who kind of grew up in this scene didn't really have a firm grasp on, like guns and kind of outdoor stuff, like, you know, real kind of, you know, outdoor, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like a lot of them didn't know how to shoot guns. They didn't know much about, life outside of New York City. And so that kind of became my beat. But I hadn't done any real, like hard military stuff. And this story about this, the making of the film came across my desk, and I decided to pursue it, and I went to L.A., and I was there, you know, on the set with them, and it was cool. And then when I went to turn in the story, and I actually signed an NDA, so I don't really know how much I can, like, close, but essentially there was a change of command, and when I went to turn in the story, the new boss had come from, like, the GQ style world, and he read the draft and he was like, what the fuck is this? Because the film is so, like, packed. You know,
right.
There's like a scene where a dude, like a midget, like rips off this dude's dick and beats him with it.
Right.
You know, that all of that was in my story, and I got fired for that day by this new guy after I had done all of this, you know, great long form work for them and everything. He didn't know me, and so then one of the veterans who had made this film put me in touch with Jack Driscoll at Task and Purpose. And I went over there pretty immediately and just never missed a beat. You know, I've been there for like 2.5 years now.
All right, let's talk about it. So tell everybody, if they're looking for your work, tell them where to find it.
Oh, it's everywhere. I would say, I do a lot of different stuff. I do blogging. I do, you said, essay writing and long form and stuff. But I keep all of the stuff that I've really worked hard on my own personal website. So that's adamlenhand.com. So that's generally where I direct people because, you know, if you go and you look up my name on Task and Purpose, you might see, you know, 10 little 200-word news hits before you get to something substantial, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I've written for Maxim, obviously, have, you know, a lot for Task and Purpose and Times, did an article for Men's Journal, New York Magazine, but yeah, I would say.
All right, I'm gonna tee up a headline and that you've written, and then and I'll just pull out a few from Task and Purpose, and then I want you to give me in less than 60 seconds the essence of the article. Okay. First of all, what are bullet points? There's some of your work.
That's a new thing. That's like a new concept that one of the editors came up with. Just a kind of a quick pitch to, you know, pump out news before we had time to really develop, you know, flesh out the story and report the story.
Got it.
You know, so if you ask me about one of those, I might not be too well versed in the subject. I might be. I'm not sure.
All right. We'll find out how versed you are in your own work, or at least that that which is attributed to you. Sergeant responsible for epic Humvee free fall fiasco found guilty.
Yeah, you know, so that's just like a, you know, that was a little news post about. I'm sure you're familiar with the story with those. You know, there's like three Humvees. The some sergeant slashed the parachute cords when they were doing the training jump over Germany, and they just plunged into the ground. And it was like a viral YouTube video of it. And so they ended up, you know, finding them guilty of whatever. I forgot exactly what the charge was, but,
What was that about? Okay. I don't want to go into that, all right, because we got work we have to do here. Marines unveil new badges for drone operators as if they weren't already cool enough. They're not cool. They're kind of dorks with drones, and they got wings now. I mean, you're not going to get the dorks confused with Tom Cruise in Top Gun, okay? So so what's the article about?
I mean, it's just that. It's just about, you know, they unveiled the new drones. I mean, we're doing, like, little, you know, the new stuff. With at Task and Purpose, like, one thing that we try to intentionally do is not come off like Military Times and Stars and Stripes. You know, we try and be a little bit more kind of lighthearted and not, and, you know, less dry. And I'm not saying that they're always like that. And I'm not saying we always succeed at doing that, but, well, you know, we want to be something that's, that doesn't really feel, like a hard news site, you know?
Got it.
And so with a story like that, it's just kind of a different approach to that story.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about Just Kills, how the Marine Corps blew the biggest war crimes case since Vietnam. First of all, how does this story the greater Haditha story. How does this story get in front of you?
So, okay, so this is it's a little bit of a long story, but basically the writer, the journalist Sebastian Younger, is someone who I communicate with quite often. I interviewed him a few years ago, and he's, you know, been a supporter of my work, and, you know, I can go to him with advice, and it's been really helpful.
He's been on Al Marine Radio. He's an interesting guy. He's an interesting guy because of not only his work, but, you know, his mentoring of people and causes. He's an interesting dude. All right. So keep going. Wow. That's good. He's a good mentor, to have.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's incredible. You know, for guys like that to kind of, you know, reach back and like help younger journalists out. And that's what he's done for me. And this story, came across his desk, and he was working on something else, and he brought it to my attention. And he said, you know, so I know this guy, Michael Epstein, he's a documentary filmmaker. He's been working on this documentary for 12 years and no one will look at it. And I think that you could see the story in here where other journalists can't, you know, because you're a veteran.
Right.
You know, this is your world. And, you know, so I met with this guy, this filmmaker, and, you know, he, at first, you know, it's kind of like, you know, he kind of came off as this conspiracy theorist. You know, 12 years, he had put a lot on the line for this story. He had been embedded with the defense team of Frank Wooderich, one of the, you know, the primary suspect in the massacre. And, you know, he had taken the, you know, Gillespie had taken the documentary to ABC and MSNBC and CNN and the New Yorker and the New York Times and all of these different places, and no one would give him the time of day. You know, I saw the documentary. I thought it was really good.
Why wouldn't they give, because those are pretty, a pretty wide variety of news organizations. Why wouldn't they give him the time of day?
I think it was a mix of things. One, either they didn't understand the story because, it's difficult to make sense of unless you have a firm grasp of how the UCMJ system works. And so a lot of it was they just flat out didn't understand what the story actually was about. And the other thing, response that he got was, you know, Haditha's old news. No one, you know, the journalists who did understand it, who had covered Haditha really closely, were like, we're not going to be able to sell our editors on this story. They're not going to commit any magazine space, to this story. And, and it was kind of like he was stuck between a rock and a hard place. And, but I believed in the story, and I say I fought pretty hard for it. And I'm still kind of surprised that I pulled it off. I mean, it required so much research. I mean, more research than probably any other story I've ever done. I mean, nights, weekends, I was just, you know, reading through hundreds of pages of these, you know, forensic reports, you know, looking at the, you know, I had kind of had to learn the fundamentals of forensics, you know, just the basics and, you know, about military law, about the UCMJ system. And so there was a really steep learning curve I didn't realize it was going to be such a long process and such an involved process. But I'm glad that I stuck with it. You know?
Okay. Talk to me about, so this gets to your horizon. You go ahead and you start down this road. what's give everybody the thesis that you put forward in this case. And it's interesting. I met a company commander who was a company commander at KSOM, and who actually that was a funeral I went to 10 days ago. And
I'm sorry to hear that.
He lived a great life, man. It was awesome. And even in death, did one of the most noble things I've ever heard of. You know, he sat down before he died and he wrote a letter to his family, and it included this line: "I'm not sure what the future holds, but for me, heaven was here with you." And I thought,
oh,
yeah, exactly.
It's heavy.
Yeah, I mean, even in death, he leads, right, by consoling and filling them with this love. Even as he's, you know, no longer here among us. And so,
that's incredible.
So in a conversation with him one night, he asked me if I knew anything about My Lai. And I said, well, yeah, I know the basics. And then after I got off the phone, I thought, you know what? I don't probably know as much as I should. And I went to school about what happened at My Lai. And so, in reading your work, it was interesting for me, you know, to see if there were any similarities, but how long have you been working on this?
Well, I first met got the process started probably 6 months ago, and I had some other projects that I had to kind of clear off my plate beforehand. I did like another kind of investigative story that was like a 3-part series, and then so I finished that about 4 months ago, and then jumped straight into this, which, you know, ideally I should have, you know, I would have taken a break, but,
right.
So yeah, it was 4 months. It was much longer than was kind of fair to my colleagues because they had to pick up my slack and, you know, every story I'm not writing, they have to write. And, you know, it was a big investment by Task and Purpose, and Zach, my CEO, I mean, I got to hand it to him. Like, no other publication that I'm aware of would have ever taken that risk on a story like this. And simply because I was saying, like, look, there's something here. I don't know exactly what it is, but there's something wrong happened here. So, like I said, 4 months. Okay. Nights and weekends, no break. I went to my best friend's wedding. I was working the entire time.
Wow. And let me just tell you as a disclaimer, I worked for General Mattis in Iraq in 2004.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was his staff secretary. So in the hallway that led to his office, you found Colonel Joe Dunford, who's now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then if we allowed you past us, you found General John Kelly's office, Brigadier General at the time, the Deputy Division Commander, and then if you were allowed to proceed past that, you found General Mattis' desk, General Mattis' office. So I worked for him, know him, and also I have friends that were in 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines. So I say that as a disclaimer because I come with my own bias. To this. So just for the sake of truth in journalism, give everybody the thesis of your article.
So basically, you know, in 2012, the last suspect in the Haditha massacre. Should I give a little background about what the Haditha massacre was?
Yeah. Go ahead. You might as well. Most people are familiar with it, but go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, the Haditha massacre, November 19th, 2005.
And I should tell you this too. I was at Pendleton in 2012, and my ops chief was on that jury for Sergeant Woodridge's last court martial.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I would have loved to talk to him.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. No. One day he walked back in. And I said, what are you doing here? He said, plea deal. I said, what? He said, yeah. And he said, it's over.
Wow.
I said, wow. Yeah, that's my response. Wow. So anyway, go ahead. Give us the thumbnail of, of, of Haditha, and then obviously take us through where your article kind of focuses on.
Okay, so yeah, November 19th, 2005, the squad of Marines in Haditha, Iraq, their convoy hits an IED, and over the next, it kills one of the Marines, it wounds two others, and then over the next several hours, they proceed to clear a series of houses and kill a total of 24 unarmed Iraqi civilians. Whether or not some of them were armed is in a few specific locations is up for debate. But at least in two of the houses where the women and children were found, there were no weapons recovered. There was no forensic evidence of a firefight or anything like that. So fast forward, to 2012, the last of the Marines facing charges, who was Frank Wooderich, the squad leader, so the senior enlisted man on the ground that day, is allowed to walk with a plea deal for one, count of negligent dereliction of duty. So no one was ever actually punished for this massacre, right?
Right.
And so my
let me ask you this. You've written a story. You've seen the impact that this thing has had on people's lives. So when you say nobody's been punished, right, people were relieved, careers were ended. When you say punished, you mean nobody went to the brig. Nobody was sentenced to define punished for me.
Yeah, no, you're actually absolutely right. That is the more accurate way to say it. No one was ever, I guess, okay, so no one went to prison. No one was ever convicted of manslaughter, right? No one was ever punished in a way that you would expect someone to be punished for killing women and children.
Okay.
Careers were ruined. People's lives were ruined. Marriage ended and he lost custody of his kids and that happened throughout. And obviously there's a lot of psychological kind of ramifications among, all of the suspects. I mean, life, I can assume has not been easy since then, but no one was ever, said, you're treated as a murderer, I guess. Punished as a murderer. So that's what I mean.
Okay. All right. Even if you were, you may have been treated like one, right, by the Marine Corps, by the media and whatnot, but nobody was ever convicted. It's really interesting. One of the things, the Marine Corps, after the sniper thing in Afghanistan, the Marine Corps has this thing, keep your honor clean, right? It's one of the phrases in our song. First to fight for right and freedom and to keep your honor clean. Marine Corps has this thing about keep your honor clean. I don't think they teach it very well, because based on what I saw at My Lai and what I've seen and what I know of, relative to Haditha, you keep your honor clean for you because you have to live with what you do. And it destroys lives when you don't keep your honor clean, when these kind of things happen, right? But I don't know that you can convey that on the front side of it. It's hard to convey, do the right thing. Well, you do that because you got to lay your head on your pillow for the rest of your life. And when you don't do the right thing, or when circumstances exist and things, what I call people get their killing blood up, because of, you've taken casualties, to restrain that is hard. The impact that it has, on people's lives, it's devastating, absolutely positively devastating. And it's hard to convey that before, when you're young and you haven't experienced that. Oh, yeah, we got it. No, you really don't. You really don't. So interesting, interesting stuff.
Yeah.
All right, keep going. My guest this morning from Task and Purpose is Adam Linehan, former medic, United States Army, currently a writer for Task and Purpose. He's written an article called "Just Kills: How the Marine Corps Blew the Biggest War Crimes Case Since Vietnam," and he's our guest this morning here on All Marine Radio. So keep going, Adam.
So, you know, I think the biggest kind of thread that I was, you know, pursuing from the start was this question of whether or not the case, the prosecution of these Marines, the question of why did it fail? Why was no one ever punished, you know, the way that we talked about, for this crime, right? No one ever, the media stops paying attention as soon as the video happened. No one stepped back and tried to answer that question. You know, and this is one of the biggest, you know, the biggest news stories of, you know, that time period, you know, and everyone kind of gave up on it. And then here I had, you know, a trove of information. I had access to sources. And all of these people who were going to help me explain why no one was ever convicted. And what I found was that, I'm trying to think of the most, kind of the best way to put this, is that the prosecution, as far as I can tell, had at their disposal enough information to convict, to win convictions for what occurred in Haditha that day. There was no shortage of evidence. Testimonial evidence, witness testimonies, survivor testimonies, forensic evidence. I mean, confiscating emails, personal correspondence between the Marines and their friends, between the Marines and each other. I mean, they had it all there. Right? And yet somehow they bungled this case completely, right? And if the job of the prosecutor, kind of in the most conventional sense, is to get convictions, it didn't make sense to me, looking through all of this, how they could have wanted a conviction, how they could have been driving for a conviction and not achieved it. And so there's only kind of two ways to explain it. You know, one is that they were incompetent, right? That this kind of, this A-team that the Marine Corps assembled for this case, I forgot what they called them. I think they called them, You know, they assembled this A-team of lawyers for this case. You know, somehow they just totally, they weren't equipped for it. And the other explanation, which is the one that was, you know, that some people, you know, sources that I talked to presented to me was that it was deliberately, that it was deliberately bungled, right? Does that make sense?
Yes. So those are your two choices based on the volume of evidence, and then what happens, as they go down the road in terms of prosecution. I've got an email for you. Hey Mac, I'm curious.
Okay.
What role did all the different immunities that were granted play in all of this? To me, it seems like this whole thing was screwed up from the start. Rather than waiting and granting immunity, when you sat down to prosecute and having the whole thing surrounded by your arms and a plan to deal with everybody, it seemed like this thing was piecemealed, and that sets it on the path of not getting A, to the truth, and B, not doing justice.
So
could you talk, Adam, about who gets granted immunity when? Because this thing hits, this thing happens in November of 2005, if I'm right, and then it hits the paper in 2006, and so it gets going in 2006. Talk to us about.
Yeah, it gets going in 2006.
When do people start? When do they start? When do they start granting immunity? And how many people are given immunity? And can you walk us down that road?
Yeah, so they initially charge eight Marines, right? The prosecution unveils this case in December 2006. You know, so they charge four of the enlisted Marines for actually carrying out the massacre, and they charge four officers for not reporting it correctly and not investigating it, as they should have, as soon as, right after the killings occurred, right?
Right.
So, but I think it's better to kind of focus in on those four Marines.
Okay.
So immediately, this guy, De La Cruz, Corporal De La Cruz, he's granted immunity right off the bat, and his charges are also dismissed with prejudice, meaning that no matter what happens, he can never be, charged again or tried for the killings that he was suspected of being involved in.
Okay.
Right?
Right. Introduce De La Cruz. He's part of this group of Marines that clears these houses where the majority of civilian casualties take place. Yes.
No. So he was on the road. You know, on the road. As soon as the IED goes off, five Iraqi civilians, five men in a car.
Right.
There were like four college students and their taxi driver are gunned down almost immediately.
Right.
And not just that, I mean, part of my research, I was going through all of the photographs and stuff.
Right.
They weren't just, the Marines shot them and then they closed in on them and shot them up close and a few of them in the face. I mean, just blew their faces off. And so initially, De La Cruz blamed it on the Iraqi soldiers. And then he changed his story and he said, actually, it was British. This is the squad leader, right? I saw him, he was standing to my right, kneeling down. He killed all of these men and then went and shot them at point blank range. And I followed him because I was just assuming that he had identified a threat. And, I shot a couple of the guys after they were already dead just to make sure that they were dead, right?
Okay.
The forensic evidence says that if later comes to light, or at least NCIS determined that he was actually probably the primary shooter in that. Right. Nevertheless, he's granted immunity. His charges are dismissed with prejudice, and very quickly the next guy is a guy named Mendoza. He had gone into the houses. He had admitted to killing two armed men, one in the first house and one in the second house. He admitted that right off the bat, right? He's granted immunity next. And then it goes to, share it. I don't know how much context I got to provide here.
Yeah,
just to make sense.
Provide enough to make it make sense, so that people know who these guys were. Because I think once you see their roles in this, and then you see the way the immunity was given, you begin to scratch your head. So go ahead. So give some background on what it's Skerritt and Tatum, right?
So yeah. So now you have Skerritt, Tatum, and Wooderich left. So Mendoza was never charged. I said four enlisted Marines were charged. He was the fifth shooter. He was never charged. But he's granted immunity to testify against the other Marines. he was never charged despite the fact that he had admitted to killing two unarmed, you know, men in these houses. So then it, next it goes to, Sherritt. Sherritt had been, he hadn't been part of the initial team that was ordered to go clear these houses, right? He dismounted his 240 Golf off the top of a Humvee and, took a 9mm from the corpsman and chased after them. And he kind of shows up at some point after they had already started clearing the houses. He admitted to kind of going back into one of the houses and emptying his 9mm. He shot his pistol a lot that day in house one where, you know, women and children were killed and under very kind of dubious circumstances, right? Like, right. In the corner of the house, you see, the picture is awful, but it's like a mom and a son, and they're huddled, they're kind of knelt over with their foreheads on the ground in the corner, and the mom's arm is around the little boy, he's 4 years old. And the forensic said that someone had come in and first shot the woman in the chest, and she falls down on top of the kid, and then comes in and closes in on the child and shoots him almost execution style, and her as well. But all of that was ignored, right? The fact that a 9mm shell casing was found in there, in that house, was ignored. The fact that there was very, very strong evidence to suggest that someone had tried to burn the bodies in that house is ignored. And
when you say ignored, ignored by who relative to what? Because this thing has a lot of different turns to it. So it's ignored by who relative to what?
Maybe ignored isn't the right word. The prosecution doesn't really place a high premium on that evidence. Right.
Okay.
It starts to pursue a narrative that, you know, that's kind of central to my story. The prosecution's narrative that it pursues over the course of this case diverges dramatically from what NCIS found through the forensics investigation and through the, you know, the interviews with the survivors and the, you know, other Marines in the unit. They're not the same story. So, for example, with that corner in House 1, the narrative that the Marine – so when I say it's prosecution, I'm talking about the Marine Corps.
Right.
In the UCMJ system, the prosecution isn't functioning as like an independent entity, right?
Right.
It's being driven by whoever the convening authority is, whoever the senior commander in the unit of the accused.
Okay, and right? just so we know – tell everybody who the convening authority is in this.
So it's Mattis. Mattis is the convening authority for all of this stuff that I'm talking about now.
In his capacity as the commanding general of the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, or 1MEF.
Yes.
Okay.
So right. By virtue of taking command of 1MEF, he automatically becomes convening authority for the Haditha case.
Got it. Okay.
And so all of these decisions that I'm talking about, everything that I'm talking about, he has to authorize, right? Okay. He's looking at all of the evidence, everything that I'm talking about, he knows, right? So when I say the prosecution, I'm talking about from the lawyers all the way up to him.
Got it.
All, you know, and so, you know, for example, when I talk about how the narrative starts to diverge from the forensic in house one, in the corner of house one, the prosecution, pursued a conviction against Woodridge based on the idea that those people in the corner, that mother and child, were not killed from close range. They were just killed in kind of like a wild spray of bullets. They were collateral damage, if that makes sense, right? Because it had someone close in on the child, that opens the door to other suspects, right?
Right. Okay. All right. So the narrative. So their narrative is that these Marines cleared this house the way they were taught, and that these civilians were collateral damage of the clear, and that's the narrative?
Yeah, in House One, the narrative is that the Marines moved through just, you know, thinking that they were in combat. They threw grenades, and they came in, you know, just really quickly. Everyone gets killed in that first sweep. Right. Everyone who dies in that house gets killed in the first sweep, and then the Marines are out the door to go to the second house. So it doesn't take into account claims by Sherritt, claims by Tatum that they went back into the house, that they shot, that Sherritt fired his weapon again in the house. It doesn't take into account the evidence that someone appeared to have gone back into that house and tried to burn the bodies of the victims. One of the bodies was reduced to a pile of ash. I mean, and there, you know, there was evidence that what started the fire was like a pyrotechnic device, right? So all of that is ignored in the official narrative that is pursued throughout the entire case, is that they, all of them died in the initial sweep, right?
Okay, and what's significant about that, and let me link it back to the immunities that are given. Based on that narrative, immunities are given in 2006 when they first announced this. When are these immunities handed out?
Early 2007 is when they start the process. Also, you know, granted immunity is the actual, you know, who I would argue is the actual senior Marine on the ground that day, right? Who is the lieutenant. The platoon commander is there.
Right.
He's on the road. He's the one, you know, who initially gave them the order to clear the house.
To clear the house.
Yeah.
Right.
So, he's granted immunity. There was a lot of kind of damning witness testimonies about him. Things that the Marines were saying that he did that day. That he had gone in and burned the bodies and all of that. That's, you know, that again, that doesn't play a meaningful kind of role in the prosecution's narrative. So at least in House One, the narrative that the prosecution pursues is one that says Frank Wooderich was the main killer in that house because he led his men into that house and they cleared it and all of these civilians got killed and then they were out the door. Okay. So, so then Sherritt, who had talked about going back into that house, Tatum and all of that stuff, he's granted immunity. He's the third trigger puller. Who's granted immunity. And then so it basically then boils down to Wooderich and to Tatum. And Tatum, basically what the Marine Corps is saying internally is that the only way that we can get a conviction on Wooderich is if we immunize Tatum, right? And it all boils down to this back bedroom in the second house they cleared where seven people were shot to death. And it was two women and five children, and the youngest one was three, right? And the prosecution very aggressively was going after Wooderich and saying he was, you know, primarily responsible for those deaths. And then again in that situation, there were certain things that were either downplayed or ignored, to paint him as the primary killer in that room. And do you want me to get into that?
Yeah, I think it's important to paint, you know, the picture. And again, the counterbalance to all this, right, is the statements that you read where the Marines say, we were fired on. Okay, and you hear that from Marines. You hear that from their statements by Iraqi soldiers that say the same thing. So again, I think it's hard. One of the things, if you've ever been to Iraq, and to a lesser extent to in Afghanistan, because at least in Helmand, there wasn't the threat of suicide bombings like there was constantly in Iraq. You know, and every time you went anywhere, you rolled the dice because a white op will pull up next to you and detonate, and everybody dead. And this company replaced the company in Iraq that had suffered the most casualties when an Amtrak was blown up with a bunch of Marines in it, when a bunch of their snipers got killed. So it's not like this was a quiet city. They had gone there, and they knew about it, and they had just, what, I think, I don't know if I read it in your piece or the Vanity Fair piece, they just found essentially an ID factory, a house they were using to make IEDs along this road. You know, so it's not like this was Sleepy Hollow and this happened that day. And then what you're trained, the way we train in Mojave Viper and the things that the training they did up to that is, you know, most of the time, when an IED goes off, right, it's going to, unless it's just a pressure plate laid somewhere out in the middle of nowhere, but if it's in a city, they functioned it, okay? Because if they don't command detonate it, then it has a chance to kill one of the local population. And they don't want that because then the population turns against them. So if it's command detonated, more than likely, you're going to get direct fire right behind that. So you're spring-loaded after this happens, and that's just the world that you live in. And then once, and so, and again, and it's not chrome and you see what's going on. It's confusion. It's smoke. It's people screaming and yelling, you know, and it's bits and pieces of information, and you're trying to do what you're supposed to do in that world. Suffice it to say, and Adam's lived this, it's a shitty situation that you find yourself in, and you're trying to lead and make sense of it. And we're walking through one where, in my opinion, people don't lead the right way, and things don't happen the way they should. And so yeah, keep going. But I think it's important to people can understand this shit's not easy. Right, and Woodridge never done it before. Woodridge never done it before, and so
I think two.
Go ahead.
Well, I'd say two things, you know, to kind of put off that is one that this was the first time that this squad had been in combat in Haditha.
Right.
And the second thing is important to keep in mind is that the killings. Happened over a period of like between 2.5 and 3 hours. There was a lot of kind of dead space in between some of the killings, right? So at some point it stops becoming that they're clearing the houses, right? Like they're not just sweeping through the houses at a certain point.
Right.
They're in them and they're like there, like it's kind of, like what are they doing in that?
Right.
And I do believe that that the Marines thought that they were in combat initially, that they were being fired on. And I think that they went in with that mentality, and the way that Mike Maloney, the MCIS investigator, you know, put it to me was that their adrenaline got going, and then at a certain point, they just couldn't turn it off.
And let me tell you, it's that point that I was alluding to a little bit ago. You know, again, when you bust into a house and you're clearing it, right? What clear doesn't mean is kill civilians in there. Okay, what you've hopefully identified is a target, and you go in there, and I can even understand, you know. You know, you're doing this for the first time. Boom, the door gets kicked in. All of a sudden, there's somebody standing there. Boom, he's dead. And you look down, and it's an elderly man, and he's unarmed. Okay, at that point, whoever's leading that needs to note that. Now, that may just be unfortunate because we know we got shot. In our minds, and it might not play out forensically, but in our minds, we know we got shot at from here. Our lieutenant told us to clear this, right, and we're going to clear it. Okay, and this is how we do it. with violence of action, because there's the quick and the dead in this house, and we're not going to be the dead. And that's the mindset. That's the world that you live in, right? And I can even say, that, right, to the grenade goes in the first room, and you spray. At that point, somebody has to, that's in charge. And again, this is second guessing. 12 years later. But what we hope is that guy in Woodridge's spot yells, freeze, stop, all right? And you get that shit under control, okay? It didn't happen like that. Because, again, what I want people to know is this is not easy, okay? And as Adam said, these guys are doing this. Woodridge is doing this for the first time, okay? And they just seen, right, one of their Marines split in half with his innards laying on the road, okay? And they're pissed. And you roll all that into one, and now we're going to go clear because the enemy's over there. And trust me, you want to kill somebody. Somebody's going to get dead, and somebody's going to pay for this. And so it's that thing that you try to control, and in Hadith it goes very wrong that day. Keep going, Adam. I hop in on this. Sorry.
No, this is all good stuff. I think what out through the prosecution narrative, like I was saying before, is the part where they are, that they actually are hanging around or they're going back through the houses and stuff like that. Because at that point, when you start introducing that kind of evidence, it becomes a lot more sinister, right?
Right.
I mean, at that point, it's not, the fog of war has dissipated. If you're going back into a house and shooting survivors, that's something else.
Right.
That's murder. That's just cold-blooded murder. And so I think that, one byproduct of the forensics being kind of downplayed in the case was, that none of this ever came to light. This side of the massacre was received very little coverage in the news.
And so, okay, so let me ask you one of the major questions of your article. Why?
I mean, yeah, and that's something I've struggled with for a long time. And, my personal opinion, is that the Marine Corps felt like this thing was better handled internally. And I think that Mike Maloney, the NCIS investigator, he told me, like, I don't think that these guys are actual murderers. Like, if they're back in the States, they're not going to be, doing this kind of thing. They were a product of their circumstances and their training and their experiences. And I think that, Marine leadership recognized that and, dealt with it accordingly. They revised the training, pretty dramatically. They started new, classes, and they started installing judge advocates, I think, at the battalion level and all of that. And I think that there was, and again, this is just my interpretation, that Mattis, didn't feel like he could throw these Marines into the fire for something that, yes, they were responsible for to a great extent, but also, you have to take into account the training and the rules of engagement and some of their experiences in Fallujah, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. It makes sense to me. So the Marine Corps carves out this narrative. It assigns immunity of the people that go into the house. Mendoza gets immunity, Tatum gets immunity, and Skerritt gets immunity.
Skerritt gets immunity. And so when Mattis hands off the case to General Helen, there's only two Marines facing charges, and that's Tatum and Woodridge. And again, the internal discussion happening within the Marine Corps, at least what they're telling themselves, is the only way that we can convict Woodridge is if we immunize Tatum, which not necessarily the case. There are other ways to get a suspect to flip a suspect, right? You can offer them a reduced sentence, right? But instead, you know, as soon as the case gets handed off to Helen, Helen grants Tatum immunity, and now it's all of the enlisted Marines testifying against Woodridge. And at that point, right, if all of the forensic evidence is pointing to the other Marines, and that the Marine Corps, the prosecution knew that it was pointing to the other Marines, what did they have planned for Woodridge's trial? How are they going to put a bunch of witnesses who were implicated in this same, in these murders, and make them, you know, kind of trustworthy, make their testimony valid or trustworthy to the jury, right? Because at that point, the entire prosecution's case hinged on their on their testimony. The forensics did not support it at all. And so, the way the system generally works is that the investigators are, you know, a big player in the prosecution's case. You know, the prosecution would have brought the NCIS investigators on the stand, and they would have said, here's all of the evidence that supports a conviction against Frank Woodridge. But instead, they put on a case that against Woodridge that if the investigators had taken the stand in his case, they would have completely contradicted that case.
Sorry.
And that's where it starts, you know, I mean, how that's ignorance. I mean, that's very incompetent, right? I think.
Okay. Well, so to me, according to your article, at that point you have a choice in what to believe, right? That this narrative that the Marine Corps chose when it said Woodridge is a guy, these civilians were killed as a result of the clear. Woodridge was running the clear. He should have had, you know, tighter control on them. He didn't maybe pull the trigger on each one of these, but he's the guy, and that's the narrative. So that what can we charge Woodridge with? Could we charge him with murder?
Well, that's the thing. They were charging him with some of the kills that the forensics and forensic investigators were saying that he most likely wasn't responsible for. Right. So he was charged with being responsible for other Marines killing civilians, but he was also charged directly with pulling the trigger on the women and children in that back bedroom and the corner of the house, right? And also the guys on the road. So it wasn't just that they were saying he was responsible as, you know, just by virtue of being the leader. They were painting him as the chief executioner, if that's one way to term it. Right?
Do they have then the next question is, what can you prove in court? Right? What can you prove? You can charge whatever the hell you want to, but what can you prove in court is a different issue. And so they have this narrative. Woodridge is the only one now that's going to go to trial, and what can you actually prove in court? And I'll just say let's just say the forensics contradicts this. How do we do it then?
That's what I mean. Your guess is as good as mine, and you know, and all of the kind of the experts, the former lawyers, and you know, staff judge advocates that I interviewed, you know, there were two theories. One, again, that this was just incredible, you know, extreme incompetence. And the other is that they were pursuing a conviction that they knew that they couldn't win. And because to convict Woodrich at this point, by the time he goes to court-martial, you have to accept that the other Marine suspects are telling the truth on the stand because the charges are not supported by the forensic evidence. And so where that gets tricky is when the Marines go on the stand and their stories start to contradict each other. They're impeaching each other.
And they do, and they do almost from the start. Yes. I mean, it's not like this is a narrative that all kind of fits together nicely, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, all of their statements are contradicting each other. So at that point, right, like if you were a prosecutor, you could say all of these testimonies are unreliable. We're going to focus more heavily on the forensics and on the survivor testimonies. And they don't. They choose not to. They choose to really focus in on to trust these Marines, despite the fact that De La Cruz, for example, I think had to change his story 5 different times over the course of the case. And the fact that, you know, you're putting Mendoza on the stand against Woodrich and he's telling a story that cannot be true if Tatum's story is also true. One of them has to be false. Right? Stuff like that. But again, the entire case against Woodrich hinges on that. So it's no surprise that they went for the plea deal because they had no case at all. And the other thing that's important to note is that the nature of the immunity that they granted these Marines would have allowed for them to pivot the case had they wanted to. It would have been challenging, but they could have pivoted to say, you know, saying that, you know, this guy was actually the primary shooter and Mendoza was the primary shooter in the bedroom of house two, you know, or so-and-so, shot the woman and the child in the corner, but they never do that. They just stay kind of single-mindedly focused on Woodrich the entire time.
Do they have any other option? Do they have any other option? Okay, so when we look at that, that decision gets made in late 2006, early 2007, yes? Who we're going to go after and who we're going to immunize. So that strategy has already been laid down in terms of this is what we think happened, this is who's culpable, this is how we're going to convict them. As that strategy got laid out in 2006, immunity's granted, and then now everybody lawyers up, and then statements start changing, what can we prove, you know, that's irrefutable, blah, 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 and this thing gets messier and messier and messier.
Yeah, so initially I thought, okay, they just backed themselves into a corner,
right?
They, like, laid out this strategy, and there was no turning back as soon as they gave all of this immunity out. But technically, that's not true.
Okay.
Right? And so that's why, you know, I thought it was really significant. In the article, I talk about the survivor testimony of Safa, the 12-year-old girl who was in the back bedroom of House 2 who survived, the sole survivor. And within a month of Mendoza being granted immunity, she gave the prosecutors an interview that undermined their case against Woodrich, right? And it never comes into play. NCIS, Mike Maloney, the lead forensics investigator told me, you know, that they withheld that testimony from him for 7 months. And the second that he saw it, it completely changed his reconstruction of what happened in that bedroom. and removed Woodrich as the primary shooter and put Mendoza in his place. Right? But that never comes into play. And they have this information all along. They had that information even before Mendoza ever testified. So his immunity hadn't even kicked in yet. He had not even, there was nothing, they could have immediately pivoted to him at that point. Right? So to, you know, if you're going after Woodrich and you want to say that not only is his decisions that he made as a leader are responsible for this, but his actions is a trigger puller, or two, like, that's a, there's, it's a very weak case.
Right. So, the next question is, they choose not to pivot the case, as you pointed out. Is it incompetence? What is it? Because, I mean, knowing, you know, Secretary Mattis, and I even talked about the transgender thing. I mean, what the president said, I think he didn't faze him. He went about, you know, studying the issue, and I think what he did was he proposed a strategy for the DOD that I think is consistent with you got to be a widget to join the military. You can't need surgery. You can't need hormone replacement therapy. We can't deliver a refrigerator for your, you know, for your hormone medication. We can't do that. And so I, and again, that was not what the president wanted to hear. I mean, and to me, you could put a gun to his head and tell him to lie, and he'll tell you to pull the trigger. So what happened? What is your, give us your best sense of looking at some of, certainly there was mistakes made in immunity, mistakes made in charging. At the end of the day, does the Marine Corps really make the plea deal, in your opinion, so that the investigators, the NCIS investigators, don't get on the stand and blow the whole thing up? Is that a consideration?
Yeah, I mean, I really think that the plea deal was the timing of it wasn't random. I mean, it would have been hugely embarrassing to put these investigators on the stand, and then for them to point at your star witnesses and say that they are, you know, that they are actually more likely to be, you know, that they're lying or that they're more culpable than the prosecution's treating them, that they're responsible for things that Woodrich is being charged with. I think it would have been hugely embarrassing. And, you know, the prosecution was, you know, was approached the Woodrich's defense team with that plea deal. And the plea deal was way, 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 way more generous than what the plea deal that the defense team had previously proposed to them. And so Neil Puckett was just like, wait, you're one count of negligent dereliction of duty, that's it? You know, no time in the brig, that's all you want? I mean, they would have settled for something
much more substantial.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that they needed that plea deal. The prosecution needed that plea deal, just as much as anyone. And, you know, one guy was telling me, you know, he's sitting in the courtroom, when Mendoza takes a stand and then Tatum, and everyone was just kind of like baffled. Why are you putting these guys on the stand? And he said that at that point, it kind of dawned on him that everyone in the courtroom wanted the exact same thing. Defense, prosecution, you know, the Marine Corps, and that was not a guilty verdict, right? An acquittal or a plea deal. And so there's only, again, is it incompetence? I mean, that is, you know, you could always fall back on that argument.
Right.
You know, you could just say, no, we messed up. It's impossible to get around that argument.
Right.
You know, and that's why I, you know, went to great lengths to kind of show in the article every single, or as many steps as I possibly could. So you as a reader can go through, say, you know, and make that decision for yourself. I will say that I did, you know, some of the people that I interviewed, experts and stuff like that, there were certain things that they simply could not accept. They would not accept things that I was telling them that I had drawn from my own research, and they were just dismissing them as false. And so, in you know, they were the ones that were making the incompetence argument to me. You know, I had one tell me that that conversation with Neil Puckett and Kurt Kumagai that I put at the beginning never happened. He just said, I can't accept that. I can't accept that that conversation ever happened. And he's friends with Neil Puckett. And I said, why don't you give him a call and ask him? I have a video of it. So I don't know.
Okay. All right. Let me read you another email. Mac, I think you've succeeded in painting a picture of the difficulty of fighting an insurgency. Listening to you and Adam this morning has really left me sitting here staring at my computer, and you see young men go off to war in Iraq and Afghanistan and then come home, and you have no idea the complexity of the situations that they were involved with, the life and death nature, civilians mixed in, and it can all change in a second. My question is, I've seen headlines about this documentary, I believe it's called House 2, that implicate General Mattis in something nefarious relative to this cover-up. I'd be curious to hear Adam's thoughts on that. So, yeah, Adam, give us there's an easy one for you. Give us your thoughts on that.
Well, so when I first started reporting this, you know, I worked with a lot of Marines, you know, who served under Mattis, and,
right.
And I have great respect for Mattis, and you know, I did not set off to write this article, you know, hoping to be able to take that man down, because I want him where he is more than anything, and I wrestled a lot with, I think one of the big things that was driving my research is trying to make sense of some of the decisions that he made in this case and why he would make them. And I wanted to, you know, hopefully give the reader a sense of, like, if this was intentional, like, why? What would be the justification for that? I think that if it was intentional, that it wasn't coming from a nefarious place. Like, this wasn't an attempt to kind of get away with murder. I think that it was coming from a place of sympathy for the Marines themselves, and from a sense of confidence that the Marine Corps would be able to shift fire, adjust its tactics, its rules of engagement, and do everything necessary to ensure that a haditha never happened again, and that did not require Marines going to jail. However, you have to keep in mind that 24 people were killed, and little kids were in those houses and watched this happen, and none of them were ever, like, never had that satisfaction of someone seeing get punished for this. So it's not like a victimless act if it was indeed intentional. And one thing that really kind of, I, that I kept, you know, bumping up against was that letter that he wrote to share it.
Right.
Everything that I told you is, was, he had, Mattis was, had that information right in front of him. He had testimonies from other Marines saying that, you know, that Sherritt had talked about, you know, executing people and covering it up. He had the survivor testimonies. He had Sherritt's own testimony saying that he had gone back into the house. He had Caleb saying that Sherritt came to him and asked for another 9mm magazine because he had spent all of his ammo in the first house. They had, you know, a 9mm shell casing and in the back bedroom, house two, and also one in house one. All of that. He was looking at that, and then he writes that letter.
Well,
like, that letter was completely unnecessary.
Tell people about the letter. Explain what the letter is.
So when these Marines are given granted immunity, their, or the charges are dismissed or both, they get a letter from the Marine Corps, usually from the staff judge advocate. So basically who would have been Mattis's assistant saying, you know, hereby, you know, you have testimonial immunity to cooperate with the prosecution, you know, this and that. It's very short. But Mattis personally wrote the letter to Sherritt. And it's, you know, it's like four paragraphs long, and it's kind of, and it's very heartfelt. And it's not, you know, it's like a personal, very, very personal correspondence between two Marines. And he's essentially saying, I, like, people don't, civilians don't understand what you have been through. They don't understand what war is really about. And that, in my eyes, and also in the eyes of the law, you're innocent. And, you know, he puts in, I mean, he goes to great lengths to kind of express this idea that, to some extent, I think that Sherritt was a victim of the circumstances. And, in communicating that to Sherritt. Now, he didn't have to do that at all. You know, like I said, it's standard to just send a few sentences, you know, just legal jargon.
Right.
So it was kind of hard for me to wrap my head around that letter. And it's also hard for me to wrap around, you know, and then also what, you know, Mattis told Dexter Filkins at the New Yorker. I mean, he's really kind of echoing what he says in that letter, which is, you know, we have to, you know, I had to, we have to be sympathetic to these guys, these enlisted Marines, because they had to go and do something that the vast majority of Americans, you know, didn't have the courage to do. And so, you know, that says to me that he had approached his role with a certain degree of, or a great degree of sympathy, for the suspects themselves. You know, and I think it, I mean, is that wrong or right?
No, but the
letter, I don't know. I
the letter betrays, I think you're right in that the letter is uncommon. It's completely out of the ordinary, and it betrays Mattis's where he is with this case. Let me just read, I'm just going to read the part that you included in the article.
Yeah.
Quote, the experience of combat is difficult to understand intellectually and very difficult to appreciate emotionally. He goes on, our way is right, but it is also difficult. The challenges of this combat environment put extreme pressures on you. And then another piece of it is, one of our nation's most articulate Supreme Court justices, detached reflection cannot be demanded in the face of an uplifted knife. And, you know, it's so, and that is very much him. I mean, and I will tell you this, I'm sure that he read about the adjudication of My Lai. I'm sure he read about the adjudication of war crimes trials in the Korean War as well, and what the country did well and what it did poorly. And it seems like in most of the discipline that gets handed out, it is young enlisted soldiers and Marines that get hammered, and then the people that lead them tend not to get touched by this kind of stuff. You saw that at Abu Ghraib, where sergeants and staff sergeants, you know, went to the brig, went to jail. And, you know, and there wasn't a brigadier general, a lieutenant colonel, a major, a captain that went. So in understanding him and how he would approach this, he would have got on board with all of that. And so I thought that was a very interesting part of the audience, of the narrative of your story. When this thing finally concludes, right, isn't there a piece in Woodridge's court-martial where they say that the witnesses say, hey, we lied on our initial statements and we're not going to testify, or is that me not remembering that right?
No, I mean, De La Cruz testifies, Mendoza testifies, Tatum testifies. They are under cross examination. I think De La Cruz and Mendoza admit to lying, having lied to the investigators. The one person who's not on the prosecution's witness list is Sherrod. Sherrod is going to be a defense witness, actually. I mean, which makes sense because his narrative really didn't fit the prosecution's at all. But Neil Puckett really wanted to bring him up on the stand and never had an opportunity to. None of the survivor testimonies were introduced at the court-martial. So it was basically, you know, some experts and the Marine suspect themselves, and that was it.
All right, I've had you on here for about 2 hours. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about this case that you want people to know?
Well, I think that there should be a serious discussion about reforming the UCMJ. Because we're still at war. We're still waging counterinsurgencies. And in 2005, that was kind of an awkward transition period. But we're now 13 years into like full blown counterinsurgency. And I think that we have to have a military justice system that takes that into account. Because when service members go off the reservation like this, and when they are not punished for it, it only undermines that mission. Haditha became a much more dangerous place as a result of what these Marines did. You know, I think it's probably safe to say that other Marines died as a result of their action. I'm sure you've seen it firsthand, and I've seen it firsthand. When you kill civilians, things get shittier for you. And we have to anticipate that these things are going to continue to happen as long as we're at war. People are going to go rogue. But we have to have a system in place that's there to make sure that when it does happen, it's handled properly.
But that's the same argument that the service chiefs get when we discuss sexual assault. Your military justice system is not capable, and you've proven it repeatedly, of handling these type of cases. And we want to create a separate judiciary in the military for these cases. And the pushback is always, you undermine the chain of command. You can't do that to us. And so how do you – now, I know one of the things that when I went back to Afghanistan in 2010 – that was resident, that wasn't there before, were these kind of civilian casualty react teams, and they descended on you within 24 hours, led by a colonel, and with photographers, with NCIS people, and boom, they showed up. And so I think the witness, if you look at Haditha and all the things that make it so complicated to try to figure out, these guys went back into the fight. They did two raids that night. Okay. They continued to fight every day. And so, how do you do that? I'm not exactly sure in combat. But I think your article does a great job of, reading your article without a piece of paper that you can take notes on and kind of draw little pictures of, like this guy to this guy and this, you can't follow it because it's complicated and it's confusing, and then stories change, right? And then depending on, when you read Adam's story, get a piece of paper out and take notes and draw pictures and things like that. No, because it is. It's not easy to understand. And then at the end of the article, you're left with, well, was it by incompetence or was this the narrative and to what end? And so I pretty interesting. But I'm not sure how you do do you have an idea, Adam, about how you do a different version of the UCMJ or what tweaks do you make to the justice system in cases like this? That should there be a special branch that does, civilian casualties that rise to this occasion? You have any recommendations?
I mean, I think that I agree with the idea that there should be a joint services approach to prosecuting war crimes involving the unlawful killing of civilians, because, I mean, if you look at the numbers of, you compare the different branches and how they how they approach this.
Yes.
It's not the same. It's, everyone's kind of doing is kind of taking their own approach. And I think that, that the system needs to be more transparent. It needs to be open up more to outside input. The argument that this should stay in the chain of command, that makes sense when you're in a full-blown operation. You're marching into Fallujah, or, you're going to, the Battle of Bulge, and you're saying, well, I'm going to deal with this as the commander right now. I'm going to dismiss these charges because I need these bodies on the line. But what is the kind of the higher cause that supersedes justice in a kind of a low temp, like a counterinsurgency campaign like this? You can afford to pull guys off the line when they murder civilians. You don't need them.
But again, the story as it gets told initially is ID goes off, right? We get shot at as part of a complex ambush, right? There's activity that goes on down by the river virtually all day where we're calling Harriers or whatnot. We believe those guys were linked to this event. We pursued, we cleared houses. There was collateral, there was damage. There were civilians killed who were in the houses. And we know that's unfortunate. But that was the narrative late 2005 and early 2006, and nobody gets relieved. What's a head scratcher to me, honestly, having served there. And again, I was lucky in working for General Mattis. I saw every investigation that came across his desk. Okay, and there was some rough shit that went on. I don't understand to this day how the 2nd Marine Division sees this and doesn't descend on that. And you do so to protect the institution and to protect the Marines so that you can get to the truth and say, this is what happens. And in the course of that, if somebody has to get punished, then so be it. I mean, it's big boy rules. But to not investigate it, to not descend on it, I have never understood that. And I've seen quotes from different officers in the 2nd Marine Division that said, yeah, well, 24 people killed, that wasn't a big deal to us. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Right? I was there in 2004 when it was way more kinetic. And 24 civilians get killed was a big deal on any day of the week and twice on Sunday. It just wasn't that way. So
yeah.
To me, that's a head scratcher. And the fact that they didn't do that makes all of this worse. I got an email for you. Mac, would it be as simple as a change of venue in terms of instead of 1MEF being the convening authority, make it 3MEF? Let somebody who's not in that chain shine their light on it. Would that be simple enough in terms of a change of venue? Do you think it would have made do you think it makes any difference whether the 82nd Airborne is the convening authority or the 101st is? See, I translated that.
I translated that to
Army shit so you could understand.
I've never thought of that, but I think that, that might be a nice compromise, because there's, adamant resistance to opening it up to the other services, but even just opening it up within the Marine Corps itself or within the Army itself, that I think is kind of a step in the right direction. I absolutely think that there's something there, because, going back to something you said, Haditha was a strategic blunder. Counterinsurgency, the success of counterinsurgency very much hinges on how soldiers and Marines react when their buddies get killed. Everything in between is going to be just rendered obsolete. All of the progress you made is going to be rendered obsolete if you react the way that they reacted in Haditha. And there has to be a system in place that is putting a lot of pressure on guys not to do that.
Right.
And when people get away with killing 24 men, women, and children, it doesn't help.
No. In fact, it was interesting, in Afghanistan, as part of when units came in and did their, preliminary training before they pushed out, one of my jobs was, as an ops guy for the regiment, was to go down and talk to them about the way we were getting killed and where we were in the fight, and to make sure that I made the point that if you kill innocent people, where we are in this fight, we're winning. In 2010 in Helmand, we had enough Marines there. We were thumping the shit out of that place, and they were gone. They were in Pakistan, and they were largely, gone. And so, so we had asserted ourselves as the strongest tribe. And so now, we constantly talked about restraint. You set us back further by killing somebody who's innocent, then you push us forward by killing a bad guy. You'll get another chance to kill the bad guy. But if you're not sure, you've got to put the weapon on safe, and you got to either set the cordon or tighten it up, or you got to wait. You got to do something. But a bad shooting sets us back further than you push us ahead. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's where infantrymen really make their money right there. I mean, that's the toughest thing that you can do in combat is hold your fire. And, it requires tremendous professionalism and discipline, but, we're professionals, right?
Right.
I don't know.
Final question. The title, the start of the title is Just Kills. And when I read that, it took me back to things I saw guys from My Lai say right after when that thing kind of came out. And it was their own kind of self-protective statement,
Yeah.
So that they didn't have to deal with it. I then saw a few of the same guys interviewed 20 years later. And it had destroyed their lives. Could you explain where you got just killed from? Who said that and why you used it?
So share it when, Michael Epstein went to interview him in Pennsylvania. Epstein for a long, long time, I mean, years had, wanted to confront him about the shell casings in the back bedroom and about House One and all of that. And so he, you know, towards the end of the interview, he shows him, well, first he asks, can you help me make sense of what happened in Haditha? And Cher says something like, this whole time you told me that this documentary, the point of it was to help the American people better understand war. And this is war. And the second you try to start distinguishing between good kills and bad kills, it's going to turn into another Vietnam and there isn't going to be a winner. And Michael shows him the photographs of the bedroom with the women and children, and he says, are these good kills or bad kills? And Sarah just says, those are just kills.
Right.
And I think that is, that mentality is very problematic, and it's much more pervasive than I think, a lot of people want to acknowledge, and it is counterintuitive to the wars that we are fighting now. And that mentality is what the prosecution had a responsibility for helping weed out of the Marine Corps. And ultimately they failed in doing that. And in a sense they were saying that they were just killed, as in they were justified, right? Like no one was ever convicted. They were all good kills.
Oh, see, I took it, it's interesting because the word just in there has two meanings. One just could be merely, and they were merely kills, and all kills are the same.
Yeah.
Which, and here's what I see. Based on, again, the My Lai research I did, what I see is a young guy desperately trying to hold on. That's what I see. And this is his form of rationalization, because if he doesn't rationalize it that way, how does he go to sleep at night? How does he live with it? And so to me, I see the same thing in videos, after My Lai. They said the same kind of stuff. We were ordered. And if I don't follow orders, I can be executed on the battlefield. Oh, really? Did you think you were honestly going to be executed? There's one soldier, medevac, from the My Lai 4 Hamlet that day. Gunshot wound to the foot. Do you think that was done accidentally or intentionally? It was done intentionally. Because he saw what was going on, and he didn't want to participate. He was afraid, and so he shot himself in the foot. And so to me, I mean, and I think that's Mattis's letter. I think there's the compassion that he feels is, young people in over their heads, right? Not dealing with it well. And he knows, I think, as an older guy, he knows the life path that most of these young men will follow, which is not going to be a good one. It's going to be, your life is forever changed, and it's not going to be a good life, because you can never, ever, ever get away from this. You can't. And even, nobody can forgive you. And you have those images, and you know the truth. And so it's very, to me, that's why there were so many pieces about your article, Adam, that were interesting, above culpability. Was this done deliberately to hide and not allow to the NCIS guys to get up because they blow it all up? Why does it happen? But anyway. All right, 2 hours into this. Any final words for us?
Yeah, the last thing I'll say is that the other day I got a call from someone who's with that unit, Hilo in Haditha, and I was fully expecting that the person to kind of rip into me.
Right.
And he actually called to do two things. One, to read me an email that someone else from the unit had emailed him about my article, and the other was to ask me some questions. But he said that the article for him was a big eye-opener, because even as an officer in that unit, he had a lot of this was shielded from them, those two. Right. They didn't know a lot of this story. And so, you know, in prosecuting the case the way that they did and going about it the way they did, they were, in many ways, you know, they were shielding the truth from a lot of people all the way down to that level. You know? And I thought that was really interesting.
No.
And that's it. That's all I got.
All right. First of all, we'll do this again, whether we talk about medic stuff or whether we talk about something you write. But first of all, Adam Linehan, you can see his stuff in Task and Purpose. Also, adamlinehan.com, yes? L-I-N-E-H-A-N.
Yes.
.com. You can find his work there. And he's a veteran United States Army corpsman. We don't have many Army guys on this program, just so you know. So you're now in the you're now in the pantheon of heroes on All Marine Radio. So Adam,
nice.
First of all, no, thanks for doing this. I appreciate you taking time to explain and footnote and discuss the stuff that bothers you about it and to me it's very interesting. You know, the stuff that you may or may not have completely figured out and the questions you still have remaining. So to me, interesting stuff. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate, you know, you wanting to discuss this case in as much detail as you did, because it was a rabbit hole, you know. And I'm glad that people are actually paying attention to the story at this level.
Well, you know, I talked before you came on. I talked about my uneasiness with it because of my, you know, my relationship with General Mattis, my relationship with officers in the battalion. And I was uneasy last night, and I made some phone calls about it. But I think for people that listen to the program, it's important that they understand how hard this shit is. This is not easy, you know, and it's life and death, you know, this is the first in a series of interviews that I'll do, that tries to paint a picture of, you know, the legal part of this and what do you try to do and why is it important? And I didn't really, until I worked for General Mattis, I didn't realize how important the staff judge advocate was in terms of keeping our nose pointed in the right direction and making sure that they constantly send the message that there's a difference. They're not just kills. There are bad kills, right? And we are the good guys. And so, like you and I were talking, I can fully understand going into that house and civilians getting killed. I can't understand somebody not screaming and saying, "Hey, stop! It's nothing but civilians in here," and recocking that and going about it a different way. That's what I don't understand. And so it's hard shit. But no, thanks for helping paint what a difficult world that young Americans have lived in, you, including you. And the consequences that they have to live with forever, that nobody can lift from them. And then also on the institutional side, you know, what do we do? Who do we charge? Who do we immunize? How do we get this thing right? And the struggles to do that. So awesome stuff. Thanks, Adam.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Mike. Really appreciate it, man.
All right, bud. Take care. See you.
All right. Bye.
There you have it. Adam Linehan. Here on a Wednesday edition that feels like Tuesday of All Marine Radio. We're going to take a break. I'll have some final thoughts. More of All Marine Radio coming up next here on a Wednesday edition. And again, my thanks for him too. I mean, for doing that for over 2 hours. Cause it's a complicated event. And if you read the articles, honestly, if you don't have a map in front of you, if you're not taking notes, you get lost in it, and I think most people just chuck it. But I think for those of us who spent our lives in these situations, there's a lot to learn from it, from a variety of different angles. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the group can understand it. Good job, Matt.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
All I can say about militarybyowner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Going on 10:20. Email. Mac, I'd be really interested to know about the decision to immunize the Marines that pulled triggers in an effort to get their leader. That seems to me not a very good way to go about this. Along with the complex environment that war gets fought in a violent insurgency, those who do wrong should be punished. Immunizing them, I think, clearly sent the wrong message. I would rather that the charges they could be convicted on would have been applied to every one of them, even if they were lesser offenses, because that's all that could have been improved. That's all that could have been proved. Very, very interesting show today. Appreciate your ability and desire to do these kind of things. Most would not go there. Semper Fidelis. Here's another one. I've read a number of things about Haditha. In my own professional opinion, as a retired Marine, to me this gets laid squarely at the office of the SJA. Their analysis, their strategy was flawed. I don't think it served the Marine Corps well. I don't think it served the victims well. And I don't think it served the nation well. I think General Mattis tried to do the best he could, given what was delivered in front of him. I know the kind of thorough person he is, the kind of preparation he would have done, and the kind of reading he would have done relative to those events. I just don't understand immunizing people that pulled the trigger. In his capacity as convening authority, he would have also reviewed the sentences or the plea agreements. If Woodridge had been sentenced to 10 years in prison, he could have reduced that sentence. That's my understanding. Justice would have been served, and he could have shown compassion in his capacity as a convening authority. Adam was well thought, well spoken, and you could hear some of the conflicts and things he's not easy with. Well done. Very interesting program. My thanks to Adam for coming on. The article's titled Just Killed, How the Marine Corps Blew the Biggest War Crimes Case Since Vietnam, and it was posted on May 23rd. So my thanks to Adam for coming on. And rough stuff. Anyway, one more story I want to get to today, and it's the craziness that Russia is, right? This is a story that was posted over the weekend from Kiev. A prominent Russian journalist and critic of President Vladimir Putin was shot dead in Ukraine, where he had fled into exile following threats, police said, on Tuesday. Arkady Babchenko, 41, died of his wounds in an ambulance after his wife found him covered in blood in their home, police said, adding they suspected the murder was due to Babchenko's professional activities. Babchenko, a former soldier in the Chechen War, has become one of Russia's best-known war correspondents, had left his homeland fearing for his life after criticizing Russian policy in the Ukraine and Syria. He had been denounced by pro-government politicians in Russia over comments on social media about the Russian bombing of Aleppo and Syria's war and over his characterization of Russian aggression towards the Ukraine. Quote, the first and most probable version of his professional activity, Kiev Police Chief Andriy Kovychenko said in a televised press briefing when asked what police suspected lay behind his murder. His wife is in a state of shock and police are unable to speak to her. he said. Ukrainian authorities released a drawing of a man they suspect is Babchenko's assassin, around 40 to 45 years old, gray beard, wearing a cap. Right, so they write that. They write that story. Okay, fast forward to today. Reuters reports a Russian dissident journalist who was reported murdered in Kiev dramatically reappeared alive and well on Wednesday in the middle of a briefing about his killing, by the Ukrainian State Security Service. The head of the security service said it had received information about a Russian plot to kill Kremlin critic Arkady Babchenko and managed to prevent it. Babchenko thanked the Ukrainian security service for saving his life. What? What just happened? I'm not exactly sure. So they staged this whole thing? They planted the story and then staged the press conference so he could walk out for dramatic effect? What? Those crazy Russians and Ukrainians, what the hell is going on? That'll do it on a Wednesday. We'll talk to Grant Newsham tomorrow. Grant, our Pacific Rim expert, so we'll get his thoughts on the on-again, off-again summit and the kabuki dance that continues in the Pacific. Japan's Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, come to the United States next week to talk to the president before the summit. So he nervous about what the United States will or will not transact with North Korea, and does it jeopardize Japan's interests? So they will meet. Anyway, the article that we talked about for the last couple hours is called Just Kills: How the Marine Corps Blew the Biggest War Crimes Case Since Vietnam. You can find it on taskandpurpose.com. Taskandpurpose.com. Or you can check out adamlinehan.com. L-I-N-E-H-A-N. My thanks to him for coming on. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. If you're just joining the program, this program repeats itself momentarily. So whatever you do, don't touch that dial. On a Wednesday, All Marine Radio, out.